Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 726.2C0113, certificate number 24875. Gordon Lish.
My position is that the mission of communication is to generate desire in those who come to the page to read the work, to create in that person a sensation of being enclosed by a certain kind of atmosphere, which atmosphere promotes in the reader or in the listener a sort of gaze, the way a great painting or a great piece of music might promote in you a gaze, a kind of hummy, buzzy, drifting feeling into which you gleefully escape.
Gordon Lish is the first living person to get an entry in the Omnibus, although by the time anyone listens to this, of course, he and all the other subjects are equally long gone. I'm a little nervous about that, putting a living person in here. It seems like, you know, you can't put a living person on a postage stamp.
Is that true? There's no, I mean, I suppose the rules differ around the world. I feel like there are some living people on postage stamps in other countries.
I think there are like Caribbean countries or sub-Saharan Africa countries that'll put Katy Perry on a stamp or a coin and sell it to collectors. You know, I think it's actually changed in the U.S. I've seen the Harry Potter kids on stamps. So I think everyone's chasing that money. But, you know, there's a long tradition that you can't put a living person on a stamp or on a state quarter, for example. The state quarter for Ohio is, Neil Armstrong is from Ohio.
Uh-huh.
But he was alive at the time the quarter came out. So he's just got to be some unidentified guy in an Apollo-era astronaut suit, which is clearly Neil Armstrong, but it could be any, really, it could be anybody from Ohio walking on the moon.
Wasn't that also on the back of the silver dollar at the time?
There is a scene on the moon.
Yeah.
Can you see individual astronauts?
I think so. I think it's Neil Armstrong jumping on the surface of the moon on that commemorative 1776 silver dollar, Eisenhower dollar.
Yeah, it says first man on the moon, and you see somebody climbing down a ladder onto the moon.
Sure, it could be anybody. But,
oh, wait.
Could be any one of two-bit buddies.
That's actually a different commemorative coin. The Eisenhower one got around this entirely. It's just a big eagle sitting on the moon.
Sure, the eagle has landed.
Because they covered this up, but remember, Neil and Buzz did see a giant eagle holding an olive branch when they got to the moon.
When they got to the moon.
And it posed them three riddles. A lot of people don't know this.
Yeah. They would then get his pot of eagle gold.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which they brought back to Earth.
His eagle moon gold.
The whole Apollo mission had as its goal to bring eagle moon gold back to Earth, which then led to Watergate.
Sure. Well, in Area 51.
It was cursed.
Yeah.
And
cursed eagle moon gold.
And that's what led to Nixon's downfall. Because, you know, we've profiled many people on the Omnibus, but none living, right? I mean, long dead feminist paleontologists and queer icons who were also briefly vice president.
Right. And people who died of lead poisoning.
Oh, right.
Because of their own science.
That's probably our closest thing to a living entry would be Thomas Midgley. Although we kind of described his death in great gleeful detail.
So
Gordon Lish is alive and is in his mid-80s, living in Manhattan as of this living. And he's a respected American man of letters.
A is real he any relation original. To Gillian Lish?
Who is Gillian Lish?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Lillian Gish. A little bit of a transposition there.
He's related to Atticus Lish. He his son is also a famous novelist. I guess he was naming kids Atticus in the early 70s before it was insufferable Brooklyn thing.
Before it was a thing that you found in proliferation in any Brooklyn elementary school.
It is going away now because, you know, now that Atticus. To Kill a Mockingbird, it seems like the book anybody could like. It's like naming your kid Hermione or something.
Are people still naming their kids Holden?
That one seems like it would be gone for the same reason. And when Bruce Willis named a kid Scout, that kind of poisoned the To Kill a Mockingbird well as well.
But Gordon Lish was one of these like editors from the old school.
Yeah. And a great writer, wrote, you know, kind of experimentalist avant-garde novels. I think today we'd call it literary minimalism, but he's an author in his own right and well known for creating a generation of writers through his famously arduous and excruciating creative writing classes. It was kind of a cult-like experience with classes that were 6 hours long, often 6 hours of him talking.
At where? Where did he teach the classes?
Some of them were his own seminars, but he also lectured at NYU, at Columbia, at Yale. He actually sued, I think, Harper's in the 90s for printing one of his syllabi, which has rules like no interruptions, no questions.
Oh, this is like when magazines print like the backstage writers of famous bands.
Yes, and he sued on the basis that he was a writer and this was one of his literary creations and he owns copyright.
Oh.
And their contention was, no, this is a syllabus. This is a little different than a poem or a short story. But he would give these arduous all-night classes. He would praise his best writers, sleep with the female ones. Sometimes people would faint because, you know, classes would just go into the wee hours. But he built a generation of great writers, also as an editor. He was the fiction editor at Esquire in the 1970s, and then at Knopf. I don't know if we decided how we were going to say
Knopf.
That. Knopf?
I would say Knopf. You're going to go with Knopf.
I'm pretty sure it's Knopf, because if your name is Knopf, you need a little something, you know? You need the little plosive. It's not a plosive, but you need a hard Knopf at the beginning, because Knopf by itself seems a little weak to me.
Knopf. But it's the German KN. It doesn't feel weak to me. It feels like very severe. Knopf.
But don't Germans say Knackwurst or Knödel? What else starts with
Knödel? But it's a sound we don't make. Oh. Like Knack. It's like Knödel.
Well, if we don't make it, I'm not going to make it.
It's up in your nose. It's like Knopft.
It's up in your nose.
Knack.
Somewhere in your nostrils.
Yeah, in your nostrils. But it's not Knopf. But this was at a time when there was, at least in American letters, the idea of writing as a macho undertaking, as a kind of like virile and like it was a tough guy job.
Irascible white men.
Yeah, who had some real like working class bone to pick with the world, but they were working class guys operating in the effete world of like person who sat at a typewriter all day and gazed out across a mossy fen.
It's a pretty low bar. You have to be the most rugged man in your
right
in your sixth, in your writing sixth avenue typing pool
in your book club. But it's like a post Hemingway idea of what an American writer is.
I think it goes back to Hemingway. And Lish was one of these working class kids. He grew up in Long Island. His dad worked in a millinery. That's another word I'm not sure if I'm saying right. Because if you're a millennial, you don't know what a millinery is.
No, but it's a hat making shop.
Ladies hat factory.
Shoppy.
He had a kind of a indoor childhood as a little Jewish kid with psoriasis. He ended up going to Phillips Academy in Andover, but did not graduate. He was kicked out for fighting with a boy who called him a dirty Jew.
Hmm.
So I guess Andover in that era was exactly like you're picturing.
I do picture it that way, and I'm surprised they let a Jewish boy in the first place.
Well, it definitely seemed to have backfired on them, so maybe it's a mistake they did not repeat for decades.
So he's part of the Philip Roth school of like rough and tumble New Jersey Jewish writers.
Yes, although I think he, after the fact, had terrible things to say about Philip Roth. He had a very specific idea of
so
what a great writer was.
So many people do have terrible things to say about Philip Roth.
Including his ex-wives. His life was changed when doctors gave him some steroids, I think, to try to treat his psoriasis, which just made him buggy. He had a complete breakdown and wound up in a mental institution for several months because of what the steroids did to him.
But probably bulked up his pecs and his...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's when he became the real Hemingway-esque guy. He started fighting bulls and catching marlins, but he wound up in a mental institution where he met the poet who would kind of be his mentor and started him writing. He was not a writer at this point, but he wound up teaching high school in San Mateo County, just south of San Francisco.
Who was this poet who changed his life forever?
It was the late Hayden Carruth, who...
Hayden is another great name for a kid.
But, you know, in the case of this 80-year-old man, he was ahead of the trend.
Right.
He was a Hayden before Anakin Skywalker was a Hayden.
Well, and nowadays it would, at least in this part of the country, you would wonder whether it was being, the child was being named after Hayden Lake, which would be a bad sort of name font.
Are we to the point of naming children ironically? Like, could you name your kid Atticus? Like, not because you love To Kill a Mockingbird, but because, isn't it crazy? I named him Atticus like everyone.
There are so many terrible directions that the future could go. It may be that our future octopuses listening to the show are all named Atticus. It's like the name Kim in Korea.
I think the trend will probably continue and everyone in the future will have a name that rhymes with Aiden. Hayden, Jaden, Caden, Brayden. Jayden. That's my kids' classes.
That's all the dudes, though.
You could be a girl named
Aiden.
Nowadays, I think Caden. A lot of these are becoming not androgynous, but what a word is for a name that applies to gender both neutral. Genders equally. Gender neutral.
Yeah. And these are all Will Smith's kids, too, right?
Yes, he has a kid named Olive. He's going through the whole alphabet.
Yeah.
He has 26 Aiden, kids Baden, from Aiden Caden, to, Jayden. To Zayden. Zayden is going to be in One Direction. Carruth won a National Book Award for a collection called Scrambled Eggs and Whiskey, which really sums up that kind of
boy.
Hard-bitten American
sure
poet
does.
Thing that they all had going with their stroking their beards.
Yeah,
and
pull your fedora down over your eyes.
Probably beating the first three of their four wives. Yeah.
She walked into my office and put her heels up on my desk. I ate my scrambled eggs.
It was, I think those days are probably gone.
Yeah.
Lish wound up in the Bay Area. He got a job teaching high school while I think he wrote poems and stories at night. It was always a tough relationship between him and his high school. He was, he'd get in trouble for wearing a hat indoors or for letting the kids get out of duck and cover drills.
Oh boy, I wish those rules were still in effect. Oh, he's in the Bay Area circa when?
This is in the 60s. He's he says the Pledge of Allegiance too fast and gets out of trouble. It gets in trouble. It's you can imagine the kind of milieu.
But is this late 60s or early 60s or 50s or when is this? Because this was a pretty heady time in San Francisco, depending on when he's there.
It's pre Summer of Love. You know, this is early to mid 60s when Lish comes west.
Right, because I have a kind of just an awareness of Lish because he was sort of, mobbed up or briefly mobbed up with the Beats. He appears in Neil Cassady's book, and I'm giving myself away here as a kind of, I don't like the Beats. I'm just going to go ahead and just say it. I'll take all your angry letters, but I did read them and I am aware of them. And he
didn't
appears,
have a period as a road tripping young man of falling for that? I thought we all did.
The problem is I knew I should, right? I mean, I was a road tripper and a hitchhiker, and the idea of on the road was so appealing to me that I think when I read it the first time, I expected it to be one thing and discovered it to be another. And the thing that I discovered it to be, I didn't actually like. I loved the Tom Wolfe explanation of the Merry Pranksters or his version of it, but the writing from within, the acid, trippy, drunk writing from within, I didn't really connect with as strongly. I mean, Ginsberg being a kind of a different animal. But so Lish was kind of like tangential to these people. He was never himself actually a Merry Prankster, but he was...
He ran a literary magazine for them called Genesis West. Well, not for them, but he ran a literary magazine called Genesis West.
Right.
Which was kind of a nexus for a lot of these writers.
Yeah. And I think he was part of, I mean, they would like crash at his pad. They would crash at his pad, man.
I feel like if Kerouac's not crashing on your pad in the early 60s, you're a huge loser.
What kind of writer could you be?
I mean, that guy couldn't pay the rent.
Yeah. But so anyway, I mean, he's he was there and he was adjacent, let's call it. But
he was on the scene.
Yeah.
And it actually lost him his teaching job, or he denied him tenure when people found out about this kind of avant-garde magazine he was running for all these lowlifes and hipsters.
Hmm.
And in 1967, he and a kind of mutual friend, a guy who's putting together a literary magazine, he's supposed to meet his friend, I think Kurt Johnson, and then his friend calls and says, "I can't make it. I'm with this other guy, and he's drunk, and the car won't start. Can you come to us?" So Lish hops on his bike to go meet this friend who is thinking of starting up a literary magazine, and that's when he meets Raymond Carver for the first time, the man who would kind of come to define his career for a lot of people, even though he worked 50 years as a, Lish worked as a 50 years as a poet and a writer and a teacher in his own right. Don DeLillo has said of Lish, who was sort of a mentor to him, that he is famous for all the wrong reasons. Because this is a guy who gave America Don DeLillo and Joy Williams and Cynthia Ozick and Richard Ford. And today he's remembered kind of as the guy who rewrote Raymond Carver. Lish found out he was actually working across the street from Raymond Carver at the time. Lish was working on some kind of textbook about linguistics or grammar.
And was he aware of Carver as a writer at this point?
No, because Carver was not much of a writer at this point. Carver was born in Clatskanie, Oregon, which I had previously said wrong, but it's Clatskanie by the Columbia River. Would you have said Clatskanie correctly?
I wouldn't have, no.
He was just same kind of blue-collar childhood that you can imagine from that part of the country. His dad was worked in a sawmill and was a fisherman.
That's the area kind of up by the Kelso Longview and on the
yeah,
on
it's
a
right
bend.
Across the bend from Kelso and Longview.
Right, so a big timber milling and shipping, and it was like lumber country.
Yep. Carver actually started working in the sawmills there right when he graduated from high school. He married his 16-year-old girlfriend and wound up knocking around the country for a long time working these kind of jobs, sawmills and clerks and custodians. He was briefly at Chico State in California and took a creative writing class from John Gardner, American novelist who I guess I mostly think of that time in the 70s when everybody loved that Grendel book. You know, he rewrote Beowulf from the monster's point of view back before every novel had been rewritten from some other character's point of view. Anna Karenina from the train's point of view.
Yeah.
Now that's a thing, but I think Gardner kind of invented it. And that kind of
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Exactly. Did Gardner do it before Stoppard? That's a good question. I feel like that Stoppard play is maybe late 60s.
Yeah.
So maybe
that's the origin tome.
That's the moment that changes our culture. So we have to have Wicked now. And that's when he started writing. You know, that's what really inspired him. And he started working on his own poems and stories. He was working as a hospital janitor at the time in Sacramento. And so he would clean for an hour and then spend the rest of the night working on his new poem.
I mean, this is certainly his mythology, right? That Carver, I remember first being introduced to him in the 80s, and the story was, here was this undiscovered, nobody even knew he was writing. He was just some janitor in a mental hospital who came out as this fully fledged short story writer. And I remember even, we held him in high esteem because he was the patron saint of the losers.
Sure. He wrote about working class men and women and struggling with their jobs, struggling with their marriages, struggling with the bottle.
But that he himself was this, I mean, this was during the peak Bukowski years when the American macho writer mythology had fallen all the way down to, you have to actually be a wreck of a human being to be creating great, beautiful things.
The American macho archetype was really slurring its words at that point. killing many fewer bowls.
Yeah, the
and killing a lot more bottles.
The cirrhosis became a much larger part of the. But as a young writer, I remember addressing my own failure or my own failings as an imagination by looking at somebody like Carver and saying, "Oh, it's possible to just labor in obscurity, and then burst on the scene," right? That's an American story too.
And it seems like literature is really a field where that can happen, where these fully fledged geniuses can just come out of nowhere with an amazing 600-page novel or collection of short stories, you know, that that just changes everything. And you don't see that really with, you know, painters or movie makers, you know, but you can just work on a book after work for years and it'll be the best book of the year, it turns out.
Yeah, although I guess there are, within painters, the idea is always that you die having lived your entire life in obscurity.
That's the dream.
And then they find, and then they find your paintings, you know, and you're,
that's your outsider artist who's got right. an attic full of weird Civil War murals full of, you know, with giant chickens instead of the Confederacy or
right.
something.
Right.
Giant moon eagles instead of.
Yeah. Your collection of strange, uncomfortable paintings of clowns and children that become like. The must have painting next to your Basquiat in your like East Egg mansion
starts appearing on album covers, but yeah, I actually had a college roommate who had a kind of similar Raymond Carver in Sacramento type experience. This was in Provo, Utah, so there was no whiskey.
Uh-huh.
There were scrambled eggs and Ovaltine.
Uh-huh.
but he would go every night and work the night shift at the Days Inn or the Residence Inn or whatever it was, and there was nothing shaken at the motel at night.
Right.
So he would write these lengthy fantasy novels that we would laugh at him for.
Huh.
And now he's my old roommate is Brandon Sanderson, this million-selling writer who finished Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series. And, you know, it's the number one novel in America every time one comes out. And
wow.
This was just a guy who had to write a million words and got out the bad ones while he was working at the Residence Inn.
But was this actually true of Carver? I mean, another part of the artist myth in America is the outsider who works in total obscurity. But was Carver really like a janitor who had no literary affectations, or was he was he the whole time struggling to be part of lit culture?
He very quickly became celebrated because, I think just because the work was so strong. He published Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, one of his most celebrated stories.
Will You Please Be Quiet, Please.
When he'd left the hospital, just taken his first white-collar job for an IBM subsidiary, writing science textbooks in Palo Alto. And that was published in December, then kind of a very small, newish literary magazine, and it was named one of the best American short stories of the year in that annual anthology.
Huh.
And so he was very quickly a rising star, but it was all authentic, you know, all the marital spats he's writing about and the alcoholism and, you know, that was stuff he had lived and observed.
Right. He's not just peeping through the right. window. This is autobiographical.
Right. I mean, I remember John Updike saying once something about how authors should not be celebrities. They should be able to, because you need a kind of anonymity to sit and observe other people's lives and, you know, pick out the little details from your neighbor's lives or the guy in the coffee shop or whatever. But in Carver's case, it was him. He was not necessarily picking from the lives around him.
Well, and so many of his short stories take place where he's either in a bedroom or in a, like an empty school. That it does feel like he was managing to keep that anonymity.
His stories are don't have a lot of incident. Right. They are, you know, they're not kind of your classical short stories with a beginning, middle, and an ending.
They're very economical.
Right. His authorial voice, his prose style is very laconic and kind of reticent, you know, mm-hmm. dispassionate. Events are presented as they happen with little sense of cause and effect, little kind of internal monologue to explain them. And, you know, again, very simple subjects. Where I'm Calling From is about two guys swapping stories in rehab. One guy tells the other how alcoholism has kind of ruined his life, and it makes the first guy think he should call his girlfriend. And that's it. That's the story. Cathedral is about a married couple that invites her old friend over. He's a blind man. They talk a bit. They smoke a joint. They turn on a TV documentary about a cathedral, and then the man helps the blind man draw the cathedral on a piece of paper so he can imagine what it looks like. And again, that's it. That's the story.
Right.
Not much of an epiphany.
Do you, in situations like that as a reader, those stories are very powerful because, of course, your own imagination is filling in the blanks, and you imagine that the writer's intention is for you to fill in the blanks as you do, right? You give the writer the credit of your own imagination because you're thinking, oh, of course he meant me to think these colorful thoughts. And I mean, I guess that those books are popular with people who bring their own imagination to books. If you were a strictly literal person and read those stories, you'd be like, why the hell am I reading this?
Yeah, he drew a cathedral. Big deal.
But does the...
No, I'm with you. I like stories that, and movies and poems or whatever it is that make you do a little work.
But does the world of letters give Carver that credit? Or is it possible that he was just writing like pretty matter-of-factly without a ton of metaphoric intent?
Well, here's an example. Here's just the beginning of one of his great stories, So Much Water, So Close to Home, just to get a flavor of that kind of staccato prose style that gives nothing away. My husband eats with a good appetite, but I don't think he's really hungry. He chews, arms on the table, and stares at something across the room. He looks at me and looks away. He wipes his mouth on the napkin. He shrugs and goes on eating. What are you staring at me for? He says. What is it? He says, and lays down his fork. Was I staring, I say, and shake my head. The telephone rings. That's a Carver story.
Right, and if you were someone who was not filling in the before and after, you'd find that story pretty pointless.
If that doesn't make you think, what's going on under the surface? I got to read on, you know? But I think a lot of people do feel that way. I think Billy Wilder was the one who said that, you know, if you tell the audience, don't tell the audience two, tell the audience one plus one. And let them figure out, and they'll love you forever for it.
Right.
And I believe that, absolutely.
I believe it too, but it's interesting in the case of this style of writing, which is so telegraphic, that it almost feels like the writer doesn't care whether you do the arithmetic.
Carver became famous for these stories and this particular style. In our time, Futurelings, he is still, although he's been dead for decades, he's still a really potent pop culture signifier. Robert Altman made a very long movie called Shortcuts, interweaving different Carver short stories.
I love the fact that you are reading aloud from an edition of the Library of America. That's a wonderful edition.
I love the Library of America, and I hope these are still in the rubble for you listeners. I mean, the books always tell you that it's acid-free paper. It won't turn yellow or brittle. The sewn bindings allow the book to open easily and lay flat, blah, blah. I guess this will all be tested.
Yeah, that's
depending
right.
Depending on, you know, where you find the Library of America.
And you have a nice plastic dust cover on it. Like, it's I feel like they're great additions, and I think they will survive the apocalypse. I have a few.
Well, this particular collected Carver, which the Library of America put out in 2009, is actually a kind of an interesting and controversial edition of his work, which we should get to.
There's a lot of controversy about Carver and
sure.
and his relationship with the title of this episode.
Gordon Lish. When he met Lish, when it turned out they were writing textbooks across the street from each other, they quickly became friends and drinking partners. That's what it meant to be Raymond Carver's
sure.
friend
sure.
in 1967.
It used to be what it meant to be my friend.
And in 1969, Lish got hired as the fiction editor of Esquire magazine, straight from this textbook job, pretty much on the strength of a very brazen cover letter he just wrote to Esquire, telling them that he wanted to remold fiction in his image and you should give me a shot.
Is that really a thing that you could do even then?
It seems unlikely even then, but that's what he did. He wrote a letter and was immediately hired and wrote some manifesto in its pages about how he was going to be Captain Fiction and he was going to just change the face of American letters by printing all this great new avant-garde fiction.
Wow, it's like it feels a little bit like Tavi Gevinson, just someone who comes out of nowhere and just...
Who is Tavi Gevinson?
Tavi Gevinson is a young woman, a young American woman, who at the age of 12 started writing a blog about fashion. And it was like preternaturally sophisticated and smart, but also really smart about fashion, which there's so little of, you know, fashion.
Especially in sixth grade classrooms.
Well, and just in general, that culture tends to be really...
you do hear people saying dumb stuff about fashion all the time.
You really do. And
you know what's in this season? Style. Great. Good to hear.
But within, you know, I mean, there is a level at which style and fashion are an art form. And you can comment on it critically, but also you can engage in it. It's interesting, and it's ground where you can take a very little amount of information and expand upon it in your imagination until, you know, until it has real meaning. Anyway, she was this young woman that was writing this blog out in the middle of nowhere. And it became I guess she was from Chicago. It became like she was a figure of fascination initially because people doubted she was writing this stuff. It was too sophisticated.
And there have been frauds of this kind before.
But
she was the real deal.
Yeah, and her parents were just like, yeah, we don't know where she gets it. You know, it's not like they were in fashion. They were just like, yeah, sure. I mean, she's got her blog. And she became a real celebrity within that world. And as she grew up, there was all this kind of expectation, like, when is the bubble going to burst? When is she going to turn into either a normal teen or when is she going to be unmasked? But she continued to develop as a writer. And now, although she's only 21, even now, and I've met her and spent an afternoon with her. And she's just one of those people that is like truly a gifted, truly talented, like American. And, you know,
formed from
12 years old. She just had it. And she seems to only be getting better. And she has resisted, I guess, the tremendous pressure on her that adults have tried to put on her, like, because adults want her to be these various things. You know, their whole group of people want her to be a feminist icon. A whole group of people want her to be, you know, the critical eye of fashion. A whole bunch of people want her to be all these things. And she's just resisted it. She has that internal power to just maintain her own course. I'm a great admirer of hers. And as we talk, I'm realizing it's not actually applicable, but there still is that opportunity, I guess, for you to just stick your foot in the door in American cultural life.
Sure.
And say,
especially now in the age of blogging and social media, where a lot of the barriers to entry
are
lower than ever.
Just like, hello, and you can be judged on the strength of what you're making. But this is different from writing a letter to Esquire saying, I'm your new fiction editor.
Yeah, it's almost some Seinfeld plot where he just shows up at the office one day and starts printing really weird fiction. But Elish got the job, and when he was at Esquire, he loved the slush pile, you know, the unsolicited work that would come in, because he thought that's where the weird voices were.
Sure.
And of course, as Carver's buddy, now Carver does not need a blog. He's got his drinking friend installed at Esquire and a place to publish his work, and it does. To great acclaim, Elish edits his first three collections, which, you know, just are groundbreaking achievements in the American short story. And in 1998, after Carver's death, the New York Times prints this kind of groundbreaking expose, which tells a lot of people who didn't know for the first time, or makes the case, that Elish essentially rewrote Carver.
I remember this. It was a bomb going off.
It was huge, because what's the one thing everybody, you know, he was universally loved, and for what? For that inimitable style.
Right.
And when you find out the inimitable style, I said it with the right number of syllables there.
You did.
Inimitable. It turns out that it actually is, I don't know if it's imitable or not, but it's not coming from the guy you thought was imitating.
So the implication of this expose was that Carver's actual writing was florid and run-on sentences and like, I love it, and it was really...
Let me tell you about Tavi Gerstenstenstemann for a second.
But it was really Gish that cut 20 of the 25 words out of every sentence.
In the case of his 1980 collection, what we talk about when we talk about love, which is actually the play that is being performed in the recent movie Birdman, that's another appearance of Carver in the popular culture. It turns out that the stories were cut literally in half. There are three stories that are 70% shorter in Lishin's version than in Carver's manuscript. Whoa. 70% shorter.
Whoa.
10 of them are given new titles, and 14 of the 17 have new endings. He changed all but three of the endings.
Whoa.
And that surprised a lot of people who thought of Carver as this unstoppable creative force.
Changed the endings in that he cut the old ending off and had the book end earlier, or like literally changed how it ended instead?
Like, did he write a new...
Yeah, like the woman didn't die, or like Yeah, did he? Okay, in the course of editing, did he only subtract or did he add?
It was mostly subtractive. I'm sure he felt like, you know, a sculptor chipping away at marble, you know, chipping away at whatever, the dross to reveal the gold beneath. I don't know what metaphor you want. In the case of So Much Water, So Close to Home, the story I excerpted before, the published version ends with a kind of a romantic, an ambiguous, but not unhappy romantic interlude between the woman and her husband. But the Library of America version, at Carver's widow, poet Tess Gallagher's insistence, has the earlier versions of many of these stories as well, which later in his life, he would reprint as well. Sometimes when the stories were reprinted, he would allow his originals to stand alongside other Lish edited versions.
So in this edition that you have, this Library of America edition, the stories are presented side by side?
Not like left to right across a page.
Right.
But the last quarter of the book is a collection of unedited by Lish Carver stories.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, beginners, the original version of the stories that became what we talk about when we talk about love. And in that case, it goes on for a page after the sexual interlude, and it's a lot kind of gloomier. Things don't seem like they're going to go well for the marriage. Unlike in Lish's version. Here's just a sample so you get kind of a flavor. Here is the, which order should we do it in?
Well, do the,
do you want the director's cut first?
Yeah, do the Lish one first and then the Carver one.
Oh, you want the
I want the edited Lish version. Okay. First.
Here's the edited version. Here's what readers knew for over a decade, two decades. He raises his hands. He pushes his chair away from the table. He takes out his cigarettes and goes out to the back with a can of beer. I see him sit in the lawn chair and pick up the newspaper again. His name is in there on the front page, along with the names of his friends. I close my eyes and hold onto the sink. Then I rake my arm across the drainboard and send the dishes to the floor. That's what Lish published. Here's what Carver originally wrote. I give up, he says, and raises his hands. He pushes his chair away from the table, takes his cigarettes, and goes out to the patio with a can of beer. He walks back and forth for a minute and then sits in a lawn chair and picks up the paper once more. His name is there on the front page, along with the names of his friends, the other men who made the, quote, grisly find. I close my eyes and hold onto the drain board. I must not dwell on this any longer. I must get over it, put it out of sight, out of mind, etc., and go on. I open my eyes. Despite everything, knowing all that may be in store, I rake my arm across the drain board and send the dishes and glasses smattering and scattering across the floor. What do you think?
Huh.
So we actually get to see inside her head. You know, it's a sudden, unexpected thing when she knocks the dishes on the floor. Here, we're seeing her inner turmoil, and then she does it, which is a very different effect.
Yeah, it's the effect of, if you had a cut of Do the Right Thing, where Mookie, before he throws the garbage can through the window of Sal's Pizza.
I really hate racism, Mookie thought.
Yeah.
Why are there not more African-American celebrities on the wall of this pizzeria?
I'm tired of this Italian restaurant being in my neighborhood.
I've had about enough, and I'm going to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And then earlier in the movie, there's other inner monologue where he's like, one thing I'm sure I'll never do is throw a garbage can through that window because I love my job.
I mean, honestly, having you read the two side by side, because I've never read the original versions. When I was a Carver fan, I mean, it's not to say that I ever stopped being, but
Carverhead.
When I went through my Carver phase,
Carvin-based life form,
it was pre this revelation,
mm-hmm.
And so I only read the definitive versions.
There was only one version. Who would think that? You were reading some interpolation and there was some other version that was twice as long.
But hearing them side by side, I prefer the more rat-a-tat-tat, just because it does leave that to the imagination.
Here's the next little paragraph. Here's Lish. He doesn't, well, Carver edited
Carver
by
through
Lish. He doesn't move. I know he's heard. He lifts his head as if still listening, but he doesn't move otherwise. He doesn't turn around. It's like six sentences, each about five words. Here's Carver. He doesn't move. I know he has heard. He raises his head as if listening, but he doesn't move otherwise, doesn't turn around to look. I hate him for that, for not moving. He waits a minute, then draws on his cigarette and leans back in his chair. I pity him for listening, detached, and then settling back and drawing on his cigarette. The wind takes the smoke out of his mouth in a thin stream. Why do I notice that? He can never know how much I pity him for sitting still and listening and letting the smoke stream out of his mouth. The effect is a lot like, it reminds me a lot like of seeing a movie and then seeing the deleted scenes or the sort of the self-indulgent 3-hour director's cut.
Although in that case, I preferred Carver's original.
Oh, you liked seeing her observing him.
A little bit. This is really difficult as a reader and as a writer.
Yeah.
Because I can see Carver feeling absolutely butchered.
Can you imagine you're this leading light in literature and you send this to your editor and what comes back is 70% shorter?
I can't. I can't imagine submitting to that. And I feel like you almost would have to be an alcoholic to have so little pride and authority over your work that you could be. I mean, this feels like literary bullying.
Carver was grateful. There's plenty of letters. You're a wonder, a genius. There's no doubt of that. Better than any two of Max Perkins. Max Perkins, the famous editor who edited Thomas Wolfe and Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not unmindful of the fact of my immense debt to you, a debt I can simply never repay. This whole new life I have, so many of the friends I now have, this job up here, he was teaching creative writing at Syracuse at the time, everything I owe to you. Another letter, he said, if I have any standing or reputation or credibility in the world, I owe it to you. So he liked the style too. He liked Lysias Carver quite a bit.
Well, and you can see why. I mean, it is in the writing.
Yeah, it's not different.
Yeah, the suggestion is there.
It's him extrapolated. It's him intensified.
Yeah.
It almost feels like cheating. Like, I feel like I could take a kind of a classical short story, Guy de Maupassant or something, and take out 70% of it and put it in these little rat-a-tat sentences and really make something striking out of it.
And something different.
Very different.
My own criticism of my own writing is it's too florid, it's too descriptive, it's too...
Right.
It's too tortured.
But even a writer saying that has a hard time doing it.
It's very hard
to go
in
with your own pencil and be like, no, 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 you know, ///, kill your babies. Whereas,
yeah, because there are so many beautiful turns of phrase you can't imagine losing.
Whereas a friend, somebody you trust, who produces something that's very good that you know you would never have the guts to do to your own work, that's got to be very tempting, especially once it starts selling.
But that's astonishing to turn over that much authority to someone else. I don't know if now that role even exists in the same way. The idea of an editor being such a collaborator, because now we put breadth ahead of depth in so many of the arts.
Subtract. What do you mean? Give me more. Deleted scenes.
Because the internet allows your thing to be as long as you want. The traditional record album, if you put more than about 33 minutes on a vinyl record, you started to notice a tremendous decay in fidelity because the grooves of the record had to be smaller.
Closer together.
In order to put more music on it. And at a certain point, the grooves had to be so shallow that the needle would skip because the records were just too long. And so there was a reason that record albums were all about, 25 to 30 minutes long, because you got a nice deep groove and it had made good sound. And so the limitation created the work. And then when CDs came out, all of a sudden you could have a 90-minute long album.
Right.
And we got these long, long...
They were engineered, I think the Japanese engineers insisted on 70-something minutes so you could get Beethoven's Ninth, I think is the story.
On one CD?
Yeah, there was a particular length, a particular work they wanted to get on one particular piece of the media.
But so you get these albums of that era that are wonderful, like The Cure's Disintegration or My Bloody Valentine or whatever, where you're like, this is a tremendous album, but about 35 to 40 minutes in, you start to feel fatigued.
Well, that's what they say about every double album has a good single album in it, which is literally true. Like All Things Must Pass, the great George Harrison triple album has a whole third record is just kind of noodling and sitar and stuff. And
yeah, well, and the classic argument about the White Album, like imagine the White Album if it were just a single album.
Right. Sorry if you like Honey Pie.
Yes, well, I do like Honey Pie, but sorry if you like Revolution Number 9. But this is, I think this is, talking to people that are in the business of literature now, this classic relationship, like Hemingway had one with his editor too, where it was a lifelong relationship, where it felt collaborative.
Putting your work in his hands.
But it required that there be enough money that editors be paid to put this much work into one writer, and
sure,
it not be a situation where you were responsible for a stable of 50 writers or more.
Maxwell Perkins cut 90,000 words out of Look Homeward, Angel. It's the only writer-editor relationship I know of that actually has a movie adaptation. They made a. I saw this on a plane once. There's a movie about this with Colin Firth and Jude Law, which is just Colin Firth cutting words and Jude Law being like, no, no, it's brilliant. I can't believe. Okay, it's better now. But yeah, like in my experience, I've worked with several editors at several different publishers. And
right, that's right. Of course.
Editors don't edit much anymore. They're kind of traffic cops and internal cheerleaders for their authors. And I think it's exactly what you say. It's margins. It's a very old industry finally having to cut corners and get rid of the lavish lunches and tours. And editors now have dozens of books. They can no longer take a manuscript home and just, you know, carve it.
Live it, right? You would have to get inside that story so inside that, I mean, you have to have read it a dozen times to make that kind of.
And Gordon Lish has to do it to an 8-page story. You know, poor Max Perkins having to do it to a 1,000,000-word novel or whatever.
And so do you feel deprived as a writer not having an editor relationship? And I don't want to out this so that your editor listens and says like, hey.
But I mean, editors have no time to listen to podcasts.
Do you wish that you had a more hands-on relationship?
All my editors have been great. But at first I really did. At first I was like, why aren't you... You know, where's the big slashing red pencil and all the fights, you know, right. Like I expected. My new book, which, fortuitously is...
Hey, another opportunity.
It's coming out, I think maybe the same week that this entry gets added to the omnibus.
How fortunate.
Although in the future, they should just, you know, you're just going to have to go through the rubble and see all my books.
Yeah.
The ones I haven't even thought of yet are available to you. You can see my creative decline.
Yeah, they'll be etched on gold plates and buried somewhere in upstate New York.
Go to the mountain in upstate New York where I will be there in luminous form showing you where to find my work.
Yeah.
This my editor on this book actually took a firmer hand. And I'm into that. I'm into
racy.
He always has a writing crop that he slaps against one palm while he edits my work, which is a little weird, but whatever he's into.
It's good.
No, but he would actually say things like, pull these three things out of this chapter and make a new chapter. Or like this ends weekly, like this should have ended 6 pages ago. Like he will actually say kind of Gordon Lish, you know, tell me what to do, daddy kinds of things. And I'm like, yes, sir. You know,
that's exciting.
Well, I really like it because it makes me really, first it makes me mad. Then it makes me think, and then it makes it better whether I do it or not. And it could just be my work is getting worse. You know, maybe my first thought is, well, maybe they're editing more because the work is not as strong. But, you know, maybe the other books were just came out so perfectly, like Tova Gerstenstein, her fashion blogging, and didn't need an editor. But
well, so here we are in this post-revelation, and it feels a little bit like
Wait. I want to ask you something first.
Okay, go ahead.
I think you have told me that there's something kind of equivalent in the music world, right? Where producers used to have a very firm hand and creative vision and George Martin would reshape your little ditties in the studio. And I feel like you said essentially the same thing, that much as editors edit less.
Well, and producers increasingly as the technology enabled people to make records at home.
That's a new thing too.
What it resulted in was a decline in the job of producer. In that if you were an engineer, if you had read the manual and were capable of using Pro Tools, there wasn't anything keeping you from calling yourself a producer because you could produce a record.
And I'm sure there's an analog in writing where editors are now getting manuscripts from people who have turned out unedited blog post after blog post for years, have an audience, have a voice. Hey. You know, the technology provides.
And believe they didn't need an editor at all.
Right. I have a blog, it's the same as I have Pro Tools.
In music, there is a distinct relationship at the top level. Like Rick Rubin never touches a knob. He sits on the couch. And there are engineers that are running all the equipment and setting up the microphones and getting sounds. And Rubin is commenting on those things, presumably. A good producer is taking a hand in that. But what they're really listening for are top level stuff, like how is the performance? What is the quality of the song itself and how are the sounds communicating it? And that's a super different role than being an engineer and like getting the drum sound. But these days, I would say a large percentage of the people in the music business that call themselves producers are doing both jobs. Hmm. And sometimes they're good at the production and sometimes they're not. But there's nothing keeping them from diminishing that role. And it, what it means is that now when you're making a record, young musicians or independent record labels, if you try to say, we want to hire a producer, but we're also going to need to hire an engineer because the producer is just going to be doing this top-level stuff, it seems like an extravagance. Well, why would you pay? You could get this guy over here to do both.
Right. With budgets thinner than ever before.
Yeah, and so something definitely has been lost.
Carver was initially accepting of the changes, but when his second collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, came out, he was already starting to chafe a little at the rewriting. You know, he wrote Lish That Letter about how I owe my career to you, but then it was preamble to saying, quote, I'm afraid, mortally afraid, I feel it, that if the book were to be published as it is in its present edited form, I may never write another story. That's how closely, God forbid, some of these stories are to my sense of regaining my health and mental well-being.
So he's
felt
become
a real psychic toll.
He's become famous and acknowledges it for the books that have been edited. But as he gets that fame into his head, and again, alcoholism now in check at this point, he's sober.
Not yet.
So alcoholism rattling around in his head, all of a sudden he feels like, hey, wait a minute, I'm a genius here, and my stories don't need to be edited, even though those are the reason I'm famous. Warg.
Right. Both things are competing within him. Yeah. He knows this is what made his name, but at the same time, and I don't think it's all just, you know, you're going to tell me what to do. Like, I think a lot of it is just, you know, I'm a writer and I want to see my work on the page.
Right.
Not somebody else's distillation of it.
Boy, this happens in rock music in a big way. If you think about the Smashing Pumpkins records in the early days when you couldn't hear Billy Corgan's lyrics or tell what he was saying because right. It was like all mushy, those records sound amazing. But as soon as he got into his head that he was a genius, and started...
You must hear my poetry.
Yeah, started mixing his vocals way forward. And this is absolutely true of REM, too.
The world does not yet know it is a vampire until I tell them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've mentioned this Michael Stipe phenomenon on the show before.
Where his lyrics were largely gibberish.
Beautiful, mumbled, cryptic things that would let you do the work.
Yeah, they sounded like this, like basically the South come alive. And then...
And it was kind of had a staccato Raymond Carver thing. Here's an image, here's an image, here's a movement.
Right.
Here's a person.
And then somewhere after Monster, he started pushing his vocals way up in the mix.
And writing in the first person.
And it's just like, you can chew your leg off. And it's like, no, that's not any good. If I couldn't hear it, it might be amazing.
What I really liked about Michael Stipe's lyrics is I didn't understand them and improved them in my head.
Yeah. And I mean, please, if you're a super big fan of late period REM, which I know there are plenty of people, don't at me.
If you're listening to Around the Sun as you listen to this podcast, well, I don't think you should.
That's pretty unlikely.
But no one has ever listened to all of Around the Sun.
But so Carver starts pushing back.
Carver starts pushing back. And it is an open question. I mean, you and I have each said here that we like different things about different versions. I mean, that Rat-a-tat prose is so seductive.
Yeah.
But then you kind of get the director's cut feel of, oh, but now I see, I'm getting that scene, but I'm seeing what she was thinking. And I know why he walked outside. And you're like, well, I can't say no to that. It's because we live in this age of kind of surfeit. You know, you watch an episode of a TV show and you immediately want to get online and read a huge recap of it. And then somebody else's competing recap and then somebody's rebuttal and then the comments to the rebuttal. I mean, I can't have enough comment about the art I consume.
Well, and how many versions of Blade Runner are there?
Exactly.
And the idea that, I mean, Apocalypse Now was ruined by the addition of the...
You don't want the French plantation scene?
Apocalypse Now, Rideau is like Apocalypse Now in the garbage can. And that's one of my... you know, favorite movies with all its flaws. I don't need 5 Blade Runners. I probably would have been content with any one you gave me if I just thought it was the only one.
Blade Runner's an interesting thing too, because it does have the staccato voiceover.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like.
Right, which everybody denigrates, right. Including Harrison Ford and the...
The future is really going to turn on me now that we've said we like the voiceover.
But that was the first one I heard, or first one I saw it in the theaters and was like, yeah. I mean, Harrison Ford sounds so disinterested, which it turns out he was, but that was perfectly fitting
It sounds like a noir detective.
Yeah.
But it sounds, you know, it's hard to say no to more, you know? And
oh God, that's such a,
it's almost
a
better disease. not to have the more,
such,
you know?
A disease of the era. Well, and it's true in podcasts too. When was there ever a time when a popular form of media would be as unedited, as conversational right. as a podcast?
What minute are we in here, John? I guess your number won't match our edited number because we have a Gordon Lish.
Yeah.
Who makes sense out of this.
Who tries to, but, you know, compared to how tightly edited radio would have been mm-hmm. or television ever was, there wasn't ever a show that was more than 22 minutes long.
Can you imagine if you released, John has a popular show in this era called Roderick on the Line. I'm not sure if it'll make it to the future.
Of course like this it will. Roderick on the Line will be the thing that makes civilization possible.
Imagine if you put that every week and then you put a Gordon Lish-sized version, which was 20 minutes of highlights. Nobody would listen to the Gordon Lish one.
I can't imagine how different it would be, but it might. I mean, the highlights are what you sit and listen to the long, extraneous conversation about. It's just a question of how you're consuming the media. And I think a lot of people listen to podcasts as a way of, I mean, they like them a little bit longer because their commute is 45 minutes long or they have the dishes to do.
And they like the company, you know, it'd be like, it's not like, you know, cutting short a podcast is more like cutting short a night with friends than it is with ending a short story early.
But now let me ask, in the aftermath uh-huh. of this revelation, right. in the aftermath of Carver chafing and his widow insisting that his work be revealed.
Well, we only know this. Yeah, we only know this retroactively. Carver really pushes back, but the work, you know, Lish talks him down. The work, obviously, what we talk about when we talk about love is the Lishized version. That's what goes out to great acclaim. But when his third collection, Cathedral, is being written, Carver is now sober. He is happily married to his second wife, poet Tess Gallagher, from Port Angeles, by the way. Uh-huh. And Carver is buried out there today, if you want to visit his grave at the foothills of the Olympic Mountains. The base, I guess, of the Olympic National Park.
Highly recommended.
Oh, it's beautiful out there. Great little industrial town with the mountains just hop, skip, and a jump away. And Raymond Carver's grave, he is able to push back more. He's got Tess in his corner. He's sober. He fights now over every change. He insists that there be no, quote, what he calls surgical amputation and transplant. He's really thinking of it as body parts being lopped off now every time his sentences are shortened. And as a result, Cathedral is kind of a blend between the abbreviated Lish style and the longer Carver sentences. And still a success. Lish always regretted it. He thought that Carver was better under his thumb, of course. Today, he's interviewed often from his apartment on the Upper East Side, where he's a block from Central Park, but I guess never goes out because of both his reclusiveness and his psoriasis. Huh. He's an unapologetic and irascible old man. He told an interviewer about those early Carver stories. Readers were seduced. And I'm sorry, but it was my intervention that seduced them. In doing this, this is what you were saying, I fashioned a golem that would be cheered to see me destroyed. He kind of sees himself as creating this monster, Raymond Carver, who immediately casts off the shackles. And
well, so at the time, there was I disengaged right about this time for other reasons, right? In the story of Raymond Carver, mostly.
Well, he was dead. He had died in 1988, I believe.
But this controversy was in the headlines in the 90s. And I had also recently gotten sober. And so the writing of Raymond Carver.
You were reading Les Bukowski than ever before.
I was, yeah. There was a period, you know, when you're drinking and smoking and eating eggs, you want to read short stories that glamorize drinking and smoking and eating eggs. And after that, I needed to find something else to do besides sit around reading stories about grabbed a can of beer and swept the plates off the table.
What is a more puritanical John Roderick Reed? You're reading like kind of a...
Oh, I just started reading...
emasculated John Cheever stories?
No, I just started reading manuals.
I'm going to channel all this into
work.
Field stripping rifles.
But Lish was demonized, was cast as the villain of the story for a while.
Well, critical opinion differed. There were many people who read the Carver stories and were like, yeah, this is, once you've had the Once you've had the list straightened to your veins, you don't want this watered down version.
Right.
Other people were like, how could you do this? You changed the whole character when you changed the ending. Like, how can you even say this is a story by Raymond Carver when the characters are doing their own things now?
Right.
So there are people in both camps.
But as time has gone on, has there developed maybe a greater consensus? Because what we don't have insight into is the relationship between editor and writer of all of our great, I mean, you know.
Yeah, you can't do head-to-head comparisons of F. Scott Fitzgerald pre-Max Perkins.
Right, and so it's hard to know whether, I mean, we have a really good sense in music because the role of the producer was enshrined by George Martin. We understood him to be a key member of the Beatles, and so.
And we can hear the Beatles with Phil Spector producing if we care to try something different.
Right, and we can hear them in their raw form and then listen to the albums.
Right.
And so from the Beatles on, who were basically they developed our ideas about rock and roll so much.
Studio rock.
That we always looked to the producer of album tracks and hadn't heard their opinion. But book editors, I mean, it's a much more insular world.
Barely credited.
So is there a consensus now whether, or at least a majority consensus of whether or not the Lish or the Carver versions are the definitive ones?
The Lish edited ones are still in print and probably the ones that sell better. Mm-hmm. You know, even in this Library of America version where Carver's estate in the form of Tescal are kind of insisted on including the later published Carver versions.
But they're addenda rather
than... Yes, exactly. I see. They are, you know, that's at the end of the book. Now, you know, try the bonus features.
Yeah.
I think for better or for worse, we are kind of stuck with Carver delivered to us essentially via a translator in the same way you can't read Gabriel Garcia Marquez
in the original Spanish.
If you're an English speaker. You just have to grapple with that. You're always going to see the author filtered.
I mean, I guess I don't prefer the director's cut more often than I prefer the original version.
Well, it is sad then that we live now in an uncurated world where editors do less editing and producers do less producing, except in the case of the Omnibus, where we are curating our world for you.
That's right. The Omnibus, edited by our friend Chandler, who is empowered only to take out the many bloopers and helicopter sounds.
And we are the Gordon Lishes of, you know, interpreting all of human history and existence for you.
We are the Lish here. We're both the Chandler and the Lish. But I said Chandler. Beep. We're both the Carver and the Lish. And that concludes Gordon Lish. Entry 726.2C0113. Certificate number 24875 in the Omnibus. Listeners, in the unlikely event that social media exists in your era, the great unfiltered, you know, it's actually true of social media too.
No editor.
But it used to be 100 and... What was it? I don't even remember anymore.
Oh, 140 characters
on Twitter, and that was a...
That's just not enough for people. They don't want the Lish Twitter. They want Carver Twitter.
And now how many is it? 280?
280 is twice as bad.
You know, when I first was on Twitter, I didn't understand the idea, and I thought that your tweets had to be 140 characters long, and I labored over them. And for the first year I was on Twitter...
What an odd concept for a social media site that would be.
Well, I understood pretty soon after I got on there that... You didn't have to, because I'd heard about Twitter for a long time. 140 characters, and I was like, "Oh, that's an interesting literary device."
Right.
And so when I first got on,
17 syllables.
I was like trying to get 140 characters. Well, so for the first year that I was on Twitter, all my tweets were exactly 140 characters long.
But I have since gone back and produced better, punchier versions of all those tweets, which will someday be the definitive version.
Right, they're 60 characters long. But now it's 240 characters, you can just ramble, or 280, can just ramble, ramble, ramble.
More, better, 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 no. Surfeit, decadence, that's what's going to bring us all down.
You know, you go on Facebook sometimes and people are writing whole Medium posts.
The equivalent, the 280 character tweets are the equivalent of some decadent Roman emperor eating hummingbird tongues stuffed into pheasant stuffed into a beehive. Like, this is why we're all going to die.
Well, anyway, our handles were John Roderick and Ken Jennings on Twitter. And you can find our show in all social media at Omnibus Project, Facebook, Instagram, all the things. And you can go all the way back in my timeline on Twitter and see these 140 character ones. They were actually published in a book called Electric Aphorisms, my first year on Twitter.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Now you're plugging your book.
But you can't find it.
Well, in the future, maybe.
Oh, right. So anyway, if you can find a copy of Electric Aphorisms,
if there's an angelic John Roderick guarding a hill somewhere with his printed out tweets and like dot matrix printer paper with the holes on the side.
Yeah.
He'll give you a copy.
Yeah. They're worth $20,000.
That's like a penny in the future.
Oh, also go to Facebook. We have a fan group called The Futurelings. You can find them there.
I don't know why you'd be reacting to people who lived thousands of years before you, but if you like, feel free.
Maybe that's all. The Futurelings all became AIs and they're still on there talking.
Our unchecked email inbox is probably still out there. What was the address, John?
It was omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com.
We're very conscientious about it now, but of course by your time, we're long dead.
We're still AIs.
It's full of spam. Listeners, speaking to you as we do from the distant past, we have no idea what's next. We don't know how long our civilization will survive. We hope and pray that the cataclysm we're constantly scaremongering about will never come. But if it comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, will be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.